This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, as a mutant COVID strain ravages the UK, a deal reached to end the logjam of trucks stuck at the border with France. And they call them the long haulers, a new Australian study showing the surprising number of patients who are suffering lingering effects from a COVID-19 infection.
Various times of the day where my breathing is quite difficult, it's quite laboured. I can't walk more than a couple of minutes a day. I can't concentrate for more than an hour of work without feeling exhausted.
It's decision day for Sydney. We'll soon hear the verdict on what sort of Christmas celebrations the New South Wales government will allow after the eruption of a COVID cluster linked to the northern beaches. There are encouraging signs, with just 8 cases added to the tally yesterday. But of course, there are fears the virus could still be lurking. Annie Guest reports.
In the quiet, lockdown northern beaches, it's okay to get a coffee from Alfonso Ronaldo's cafe.
It's only takeaway, quickly, hello, how are you, because we all very masked. It's all about contact with the eyes, and it's nice to see my clients come back. They're supporting me, I'm supporting them.
And that's important to this long-time Avalon resident.
Everybody's been upset. Like, for example, I was organised to go see my grandson up in Queensland. So, you know, my grandson is born 4 weeks ago, and so many like me in Avalon, we are all in the same boat.
What are your hopes for the restrictions over Christmas?
You know, hopefully we can maybe open for a couple of tables, but I don't think so. And the most important thing is that nobody dies, and that is my big hope.
Cautious but balanced is how the Premier Gladys Berejiklian describes her approach, saying it's unlike other states and territories, which she accuses of making all New South Wales residents suffer through border restrictions. The government will meet health experts before revealing the Christmas rules in a few hours.
If it wasn't this time of year, the decision would be much easier. But obviously, we do need to consider mental health issues. We need to consider what people are going through as part of that decision as well.
But with more than 100 venues in multiple suburbs across Sydney on COVID alert, epidemiologist Professor Catherine Bennett from Deakin University is urging a more cautious approach.
I think it's tough that it's Christmas, but you know, if anything, we should be more concerned, not prone to kind of easing restrictions sooner because it's Christmas.
Assuming that any new cases are either in quarantine or connected to the Avalon cluster, what do you think the restrictions over Christmas should be?
I would be mandating masks. Capping the number of people to the home is unfortunate, but particularly I think people need to be very mindful if they have older relatives and they're bringing them into a home with people from across other households. So I wouldn't be relaxing restrictions at this point.
Regardless, thousands of New South Wales residents will be in isolation over Christmas because of their contact with people or places associated with COVID-19.
Annie Guest reporting. The UK and France have thrashed out a plan to restart freight between the two countries after the border was slammed shut because of fears about a new contagious strain of coronavirus that's riddled Britain. The border blockade had halted a chunk of trade with the rest of Europe and left thousands of truck drivers stranded. Our Europe correspondent is Linton Besser, and I spoke with him earlier.
It appears, Kim, that an agreement has finally been reached between London and Paris to sort out these 3,000 lorries that are currently stranded in Dover and have been unable to cross the English Channel to get back to the continent since Sunday when the border was closed. That decision to close the border, of course, came because this new variant, a strain of coronavirus, was announced by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He explained it was highly contagious and had effectively ravaged its way through Britain, alarming France and the rest of the continent, indeed much of the world. And since then, these lorries have effectively been forced to park on the major southeastern highway in Kent and have been marshalled into a disused airfield. And the drivers have been increasingly frustrated, many of them unlikely to make it home for Christmas. And of course, There are no toilet facilities. There's no fresh water. There hasn't been any food for these guys. And some of them have been mounting protests down in Dover. So just only in the past hour or so, the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, put out a message on social media saying there has been good progress on talks and an agreement reached to allow them to return to the continent, these professional drivers. The French Transport Minister has said that French nationals and people with a home in France and those with a legitimate reason will be able to travel back into France. But the only problem is they're going to have to demonstrate they have a negative coronavirus test before they're allowed to cross the channel. And France is insisting, Kim, on a full laboratory test no less than 72 hours before departure. So although technically as of midnight tonight, those trucks should be able to resume their travel, I think it's going to be a very slow process. The prospect of doing these full-scale laboratory tests, the results of which can take 24, 48 hours, means the problem isn't totally over yet.
And Linton, is this disruption giving us a glimpse of what might happen a week from now when Brexit is supposed to kick in?
It's not only a glimpse. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, boasted on the BBC today in Britain that, in fact, this is all, you know, part of our planning and our protocol under the so-called Operation Brock, which is a full-scale logistics emergency procedure for a no-deal Brexit. Clearly, that has helped this particular crisis, but it does absolutely show Britain, perhaps for the first time, the scale of confusion and uncertainty that may occur should there be this hard no-deal Brexit outcome. In just 9 days' time, by the way, there is still no agreement whatsoever. One of the key Brexit negotiators on the Brussels side, Guy Hofstadt, an MEP, he very cheekily tweeted tonight, "Now at last Britain gets a glimpse of what it means really to leave the EU."
Europe correspondent Linton Besser. Well, apart from disrupting travel and freight, there are questions about whether this new UK strain of coronavirus will affect how vaccines work. The maker of one COVID vaccine says he believes the product will stand up against it, but tests are still being carried out. In the meantime, the World Health Organization has called a meeting to discuss the new strain, as David Sparks reports.
Drumming up support for getting vaccinated.
Many in our nation are saying, if Dr. Fauci gets the vaccine, I'm going to get the vaccine. So tell us a little bit of why it's important.
In the US, some of the nation's top healthcare officials received their first dose of the Moderna COVID-19 jab. Among them, infectious diseases expert Dr. Anthony Fauci.
I feel extreme confidence in the safety and the efficacy of this vaccine, and I want to encourage everyone who has the opportunity to get vaccinated so that we can have a veil of protection over this country that would end this pandemic.
The German firm BioNTech is testing the effectiveness of the COVID-19 vaccine it developed with Pfizer against the new strain of the virus detected in Britain. The EU has also now approved the use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. BioNTech Chief Executive Uğur Şahin says he's confident the vaccine will protect against the new variant.
We are going to evaluate that in a test if the immune response against our vaccine is able to inactivate also this virus variant. We are confident that this will be the case, but we have to do the experiment.
A different new mutation of the virus, meanwhile, is thought to be behind a recent spike in infection rates in South Africa, which has recorded more than 900,000 infections and 25,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Epidemiologist Tulio de Oliveira.
This variant also is falling the increase of the cases, but more important, it has been dominating almost every infection that we have in the coastal area. This is from Eastern Cape all the way to Cape Town.
The World Health Organization has called a meeting to discuss strategies to counter the more infectious variant, which has emerged in Britain. But the body has cautioned against alarm over the development, saying variants are a normal part of the pandemic evolution.
David Sparks. Well, there are still 39,000 Australians stranded overseas wanting to come home. The Department of Foreign Affairs has confirmed there are more evacuation flights planned to return vulnerable Australians from the UK, India and other countries in coming weeks. But things are getting a bit tricky for Aussies in the UK because more than 40 countries have banned flights from Britain, and that includes Singapore, which effectively means anyone who'd planned to transit there to get to Australia will be unable to fly. Queensland man Sean is meant to be on a Singapore Airlines flight early next year with his wife and two young children, and he's been speaking with our reporter Bridget Fitzgerald.
We were due to fly back to Australia from the United Kingdom on the 17th of February. Booked a flight for myself, my wife and my two small children, all Australian, all born and bred Aussies, apart from my wife, who's English, and we've just learnt that Singapore Airlines, which has been one of the only airlines that's had flights actively running, has just barred anyone passing from the UK, even transiting through Singapore at the moment, which effectively we've sold our house. We've effectively made ourselves homeless over here. We're due to move out after Christmas. We're basically at sea.
What other options do you have at this moment? I know you've just learned this news. What do you plan to do now?
I don't know what I'm going to do now. We spent a lot of money hiring specialist travel agents to get us back because it was the only way. You know, the government put three flights out through DFAT a month ago, and we've not heard anything since. And those flights were all taken up straight away. We didn't even get a chance to get on them. And we've heard nothing back from DFAT since. But something has to be done. You know, the UK's in a tailspin at the moment, and it'll quickly become a third world nation between all its issues with coronavirus and then Britexit, and it's out of control.
And can you see things worsening there at the moment?
Oh, it is, without a doubt. You know, there's calls for another lockdown, and every lockdown brings, you know, more redundancies and closures of businesses and more deprivation. You know, the English people are suffering incredibly under this government at the moment, and it's only getting worse. And that will be the same for Australian citizens stuck over here. You know, those who had jobs are less than likely to have them. There's talking of food shortages over here because of the blockade between the French via the tunnel of trucking. You know, it's the situation's getting rapidly worse for a first world nation. It's incredibly bad. I don't know what other way to put it. We need help from the government. You know, we're taxpaying citizens who live there all our lives. We've got work and opportunities back in Australia. Like, get the Qantas birds in the air and figure out a place to quarantine us. You know, I don't see it overly complicated. We're paying for it. You know, many of us, we're all going to pay for it. So use the funds and allocate it correctly.
Sean, an Australian living in England, speaking to Bridget Fitzgerald, and AM has contacted the Department of Foreign Affairs. Well, the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister is Penny Wong, and I spoke with her earlier. Senator Wong, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
As we've just heard, it's becoming increasingly dicey for some Aussies to get home, but this mutated UK strain is very worrying. Should Australia be banning anyone returning from the UK?
Well, the first thing the government needs to deliver, the first thing Mr Morrison needs to deliver, is safe national quarantine. And that's the key to this. And we do know the Prime Minister's been warned about the importance of a better border control quarantine system. He's been told by his own expert how he can safely operate a national border control quarantine system to keep Australians safe. But he's passing the buck. He's passing the buck on quarantine to the states, just like he did with aged care and just like he did with the Ruby Princess.
But in the meantime, we've got the quarantine system as it is, but it's still allowing travellers to come back from the UK. Should they be stopped because of this mutated strain?
Well, we always should follow the health advice. But I would make the point, the health advice has been very clear that Australia needs a safe quarantine system. And the reality is we have seen weaknesses in our quarantine system because Scott Morrison has abdicated responsibility. We closed our borders in March. We imposed caps on returned Australians in July. Labor said the longer we leave it, the greater the risk, not only to those Australians stranded overseas, but to Australians here. And yet still, Scott Morrison is not acting to deliver safe quarantine, and he could.
There are still 39,000 Australians who are trying to get home. We've just heard the experience of one man who was going to try to transit through Singapore. What can Australia do to try to arrange that safe passage home?
Well, I think Sean's story, and it was a very, you know, distressing interview, I thought. You could hear the desperation in his voice. And, you know, he's one of, as you say, nearly 40,000, 39,000 Australians who want to come home who can't and who have been trying to get home. And this underlines Mr. Morrison's failure to deliver on his promise that he would get Australians home by Christmas. But more critically, failure to deliver on the safe quarantine, which would protect both Australians here but also enable Australians stranded to come home.
The federal government says a vaccine should be ready to roll out in Australia by March. Do you think that needs to be sped up?
Well, we would always respect the approval processes of the Therapeutic Goods Authority here in Australia. But I think the problem is that Mr. Morrison said Australians are at the front of the queue. We certainly don't want, once approval has been given, we don't want to see any delay. And I think his line about being at the front of the queue is just not true. Australians can't afford for Mr. Morrison not to deliver on his promise to deliver the vaccine. And he needs to show Australians that he can get it rolled out as soon as it's approved.
On another issue, PNG has signed a memorandum of understanding with China to build a fishing industrial park on the island of Daru, which is very close to Australia. Our foreign minister has raised some concerns about that, but PNG says it is acting within its sovereign rights by considering it. Why are you saying the Morrison government has dropped the ball on that one?
First, it doesn't appear that Mr. Morrison and Senator Payne saw this coming. Secondly, we've got a comprehensive, a massive industrial facility very close to Australia's waters. We know fish numbers are depleted. The Foreign Minister has said the treaty in place would not allow for Chinese commercial fishing, and I think it is legitimate to ask, well, you know, what is it going to be used for? All I'm saying is Mr. Morrison has to guarantee that the project on Australia's doorstep doesn't risk Australia's security interests or our fisheries.
But why would we pick a fight with China on this? Isn't it just going to make the relations with China worse?
I think we should be really clear about what our interests are, and our interests are in ensuring that Australia and our neighbours' fisheries are secure. And, you know, I want Senator Payne to ensure that occurs.
PNG's fisheries minister says that the plan hasn't been given the final approval. Should we not respect that process in PNG?
Well, I think the issue goes to ensuring that Australia's interests are protected, and those interests do go to our interest in the fisheries, which we share in that region with Papua New Guinea. And ensuring that we understand what this massive project is going to be used for.
Senator Wong, thank you very much for joining AM.
Good to speak with you.
Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong. The first study of Australians with long-term COVID-19 symptoms has found up to 40% of patients can have signs of illness that linger for months. The study from Sydney's St Vincent's Hospital has found the most common symptoms are fatigue, breathlessness and chest pain. Alison Branley reports.
In early March, Ben Barnett caught COVID-19 from a colleague returned from the UK. But getting over the virus has been worse than the illness itself.
Various times of the day where my breathing is quite difficult, it's quite laboured. I can't walk more than a couple of minutes a day. I can't concentrate for more than an hour of work without feeling exhausted. The second symptom is a real persistence of chest pain, and that really feels like a sort of overweight baby constantly sitting on my chest. So I have a sort of constant feeling of almost constriction in my neck, almost as if someone's lightly got their hands around my neck.
He's one of many people in Australia and around the world dubbed long haulers, those feeling lingering symptoms after having COVID-19. Now the first Australian study of long haulers at Sydney's St Vincent's Hospital has found up to 40% of COVID cases can have lingering side effects. The study looked at 78 patients who developed COVID in about April and recorded their symptoms after 2 months and again at 4 months. Head of Infectious Diseases at the hospital is Professor Gail Matthews.
The question we're asking, and we don't know the answer yet, is whether in the people who still have some persistent symptoms down the track, whether they look different from an immune perspective from those who are fully recovered.
Professor Matthews says it's not just those who get very sick either. 35% of patients who were well enough to be treated at home also had lingering symptoms. The study also found a small link between those who'd experienced neurocognitive impairment, or so-called brain fog, and a loss of a sense of smell.
And that suggests that the neurocognitive impairment may not be because they were unwell and intubated, but that there may be some direct brain link.
Researchers hope the results will help authorities plan for how many COVID patients may need help long term. Infectious diseases physician at Austin Health, Dr. Patrick Charles, says the numbers of long haulers hitting the health system in the future could be high.
Given that we've had 26,000 or so cases, we're probably looking at hundreds of cases here in Australia, I would think. We can get things better, but it might take a while. We can gradually build up with maybe physiotherapy and other types of graded exercise programs to get people back to a more normal level of functioning again.
Fellow infectious diseases physician Dr. Jim Newcomb says authorities need to work harder to take a holistic approach to long haulers, including the mental health impacts of being sick long term.
Because it can affect every part of the body, it's really going to be something which needs a team approach, which is hard to get in the current Australian healthcare system.
10 months since becoming unwell, Ben Barnett is getting help, but his recovery is slow.
I don't have a sense of when I'm going to be recovered from this.
COVID-19 patient Ben Barnett ending Alison Branley's report. While we watch for the implications of the Sydney COVID cluster, it's also clear the grief, loss and trauma caused by the pandemic is far from over. Phone counselling service Griefline is preparing for a second wave of calls in the lead up to Christmas. Caroline Winter reports.
Between them, Sydney couple Natalie Coulson and her partner have 4 children, 3 who live overseas and a toddler at home.
We've always made it work over the last 5 years or so with, you know, lots of flights, we have lots of video chats, and that's the way it's worked quite happily.
Then COVID-19 hit, borders closed and reality sunk in.
It's just a loss and a numbness, and there's that sense of helplessness that you really can't do anything about it.
Natalie Coulson's 20-year-old stepson lives in Auckland and she last saw her 9-year-old son and 11-year-old daughter who live in Canada in March.
You go through that process, which is that shock that, oh my goodness, what's happening? Then you go through, you know, the denial, oh, come on, I'm sure I'll be able to see them. This is just COVID. Like, what is this? You go through that phase of depression and then acceptance.
She realised what she was experiencing was grief, like many thousands of Australians have during the pandemic. Jane Fisher is the Finkel Professor of Global Health at Monash University.
I think what most of us have experienced during COVID, though, is what's called disenfranchised or unacknowledged grief.
That's grief that isn't publicly recognised or marked by rituals like funerals.
So we've lost autonomy and our freedom to come and go as we would wish to. We've lost aspects of our identity, but we've also lost other aspects of important daily life. So opportunities to mark family milestone celebrations. And all of these, I think, have contributed to a sense of loss that can't be well managed.
But help dealing with grief, loss and trauma is there.
Hello, and thank you for calling Griefline. One of our volunteer counsellors will be with you.
Volunteers at the National Counselling Helpline have been overwhelmed by the response through the pandemic.
Good afternoon. What brings you to Griefline today?
Griefline says there's been an 1,100% rise in calls to the service this year, 24,000 since May, and it's expecting 3,500 calls this month alone, 9 times higher than at the same time as last year. Co-chair of Griefline Australia, Sarah Godfrey, says they're preparing for a second wave as Christmas approaches.
We lost jobs, we lost family members, we lost a sense of self, we lost human contact. So I think all those losses compounding has meant that once we're starting to move back out into some new normal, it's hitting us.
She says they've boosted volunteer numbers to almost 200 and they run the helpline 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, but argues the 33-year-old service needs long-term funding to keep going.
Griefline has been funded at a level that we just make it through the next year, and then we've got to be back out trying to get the funding again. We need a sustainable model. Otherwise, it's just not viable to keep running an organisation that is getting as large as ours at this one-year rotation.
Co-chair of Griefline Australia, Sarah Godfrey, ending Caroline Winter's report. And in a statement, the Federal Health Department says it's provided $400,000 to Griefline over the last 2 years and is currently considering the need for additional funding. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.